This is a reading by Rona Tyndall. I do a lot of reading and exploring about elephants, and this is about elephants. Elephants are naturally social creatures. They actually form complex multi-generational societies in which tradition is passed on from one generation to the next. The matriarchs coach the adolescent girls into elephant womanhood. The mature males bring the adolescent boys off on a retreat of sorts, after which they return as adult elephants, ready to take their place as leaders in their society. It is also true that elephants bury their dead. They grieve and have complex mourning rituals. They return to the gravesite year after year, lovingly running their tusks over the tusks of the dead, just as they did when their loved ones were alive. Remarkably, elephants treat a dead human being in exactly the same way. They scoop up the body, cover it over with soil and leaves, and stand vigil over it for hours, leaving only when their mourning has ended. Today's elephant populations are suffering from a form of chronic stress, a kind of species-wide trauma. Decades of poaching and culling and habitat loss have so disrupted the intricate web of familial and societal relations by which young elephants have traditionally been raised in the world and by which established elephant herds are governed that what we are witnessing is nothing less than a precipitous collapse of elephant culture. In other words, when baby elephants don't know who they belong to, they don't know how to be in the world. Without a common culture, there is no context in which to grow into their truest selves. While elephants and humans shared a social bond two generations ago, one result of the trauma of recent disconnection and unbelonging, I am sad to say, is that escalating episodes of intentional elephant-on-human violence have become epidemic, killing people and forcing whole villages to relocate. When their natural communal lifestyle is destroyed, elephants, like people, have no culturally enforced boundaries of behavior. They have no society to teach them how to become what they are meant to be. As you are able, let us rise in body or spirit to sing hymn 34. I often start a sermon with a joke, But today, God save you from a minister who's just been to a retreat at Kripalu. Because we often consider difficult issues in our worship, and because one of the things I'm talking about today is how to find balance in that, I want to ask you to take a little risk and participate with me in laughing. So you have to, if you can stand up, if not, you can do this from a seated position. Please rise. And if it helps, this is just a neurological exercise that changes the brain chemistry. So what you do is take a deep breath and go up. And as you go to your waist, just go, ah. And when you get beyond your waist, start laughing. Okay, ready? Ah. Try it again. Ah. So take a notice of how your body feels and how much access we have to things that balance out our beings that are so simple and wonderful. If we did that, if we weren't in pews and we did that, we might be still laughing together as a... So I begin with a few questions. How seriously do you take the covenant words we say each Sunday? Love is the doctrine of this church, the quest for truth, its sacrament. Service is its prayer. Have saying the words become rote to you, not really a living set of promises? Another question, do you know the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism? Would you call these a living set of promises, a covenant by which we live together? On a daily basis, how integral are these ideas, these promises to your living? My sermon today has three points to make. One, that liberal religion, Unitarian Universalism, is non-creedal, and therefore decisions about how we abide together to play hide and seek, for instance, are integral to the task of living together as non-creedal people. Number two, my second point, like the elephants, we are living in a particular time of dislocation and stress on many levels. And number three, what then might our covenant, our promises to one another be, is what we already have bringing life to us as individuals and as a community at this point in time? If not or not enough, what might we want to promise anew? So number one, we are a non-creedal, covenantal religion. We do not require anyone to believe a certain thing, certain theology. Each is free to find what you want to believe or to believe what you find to be true. An example of a creedal church is the church I grew up in Sylvania, Ohio, a small church, Missouri Synod Lutheran. We said the Apostles' Creed every Sunday, and I can say it well to this very day. I well remember, though, the day that I didn't just say the words, as I had Sunday after Sunday for years on end. I was getting older, and instead I actually questioned myself about whether I did believe what I was saying. Suffice it to say that I was greatly surprised by my own repetitive false testimony, and thus began for me my journey toward a freer faith. We are bound together here by covenants we make, the promises we make to one another. Reverend Tom Beloit describes the difference in this true conversation that transpired between Tom and two women who are all at a rally for honest sex education that goes beyond abstinence. He is wearing a collar, and he assumes that they are shocked to notice a clergy person in support of this view, because they are not. He writes, "I introduce myself as a Unitarian Universalist minister. They asked me, 'How do you spell that?' And then they asked me to explain what you use believe. I explained that we are a covenantal faith, not a creedal faith. We share a covenant of how we try to be together, not a creed of what we must all believe together. Then the questions really begin. Well, does your church believe in the Bible? My response, that is a creedal question. We are a covenantal church. We share a covenant of how we try to be together, not what we are expected to believe together. Does your church believe in God? They asked. That is a creedal question. We are a covenantal church. We share a covenant of how we try to be together, not what we believe together. This went on for a while, and it took them a while to get this. They were being challenged to think in a new way. Reverend Beloit goes on in his essay, "I think sometimes in our churches, we stress the fact that we are not a creedal church a lot more than we stress that we are a covenantal church. We emphasize the creeds we are not asked to recite more than the covenants we are asked to share." When these young women at the protest asked me, "Do you believe the way I believe?" they were really asking if it was possible for us to be in community together. To be in their community required holding the same beliefs. And I replied, "You have asked me a creedal question and posed a creedal test. Covenant is larger than creed." Many of you, us in this room, have had those kind of similar conversations with other people. Unitarian Universalism is based on another paradigm than most religions, not to place them on any hierarchy, it's just the facts. Rather than saying, "If you can affirm these beliefs, then you can come in," we say, "Come on in and take a journey in community toward what you do believe." It can, on the surface, sound free and easy. Yet if you scratch the surface of what it means to be a covenantal church, what exactly is our covenant, and how does it inform our personal and communal lives? This is the ongoing question, which in my mind makes liberal religion more real and more vital and more rigorous, if we choose to go there. So my first point, and perhaps made especially for newer people, is that we are a non-creedal covenantal religion. And therefore, whatever covenant we have has to be thought about and consistently revisited and discussed and pondered as times change, as more people come to be with us. My second point today, we are in a particularly acute time of disenchantment and confusion and stress in our individual and national and churchly lives. These acute times come and go in the span of centuries. It is our time now to figure out how to live in this particular time. The reading about what is happening in elephant culture mirrors so very well the human culture of our time. We are divided in many ways and wondering where our habitat is. In younger families, and this is one of my greatest concerns as a minister, there is so much activity because people are working more hours and there is increased stress on the demands of parenting and what is required and what a child has to have on their resume going forward. A movement from thing to thing, the stress of managing it all, overly busy. Anxiety as a nation based on seismic shifts in political behavior and discourse, and confusion about what exactly democracy is these days, long time developing economic shifts that make it so that my children's generation will not overall live a better life financially than those two above them. It is true that there is a lot more financial stress here in this room than we talk about with one another. All of these stresses can lead to a sense of having no mooring or of free-floating anxiety. We can take that trip down expressing our fear and complaint about others. It's so easy to go down that. And we need some of that. I'm not saying we don't. But we can become like the elephants without a social context within which to guide ourselves towards the humans we are born to be. Without such a context, and I'm saying that there aren't very many of them left in the culture, churches being one environment that can be a mooring for people. Without that, we, like the baby elephants, do not get what we need to thrive. I say these things at the risk of having you think that I view our current life as only dire. Not at all. My life was so enriched by showing up for the talent show on Friday. From ages, I'm guessing, 9 to 90, we were witness to offerings of talent, a place where each had the opportunity to be appreciated without judgment and with love, to have their moment in the light. This was a well-spent couple of healing hours. If we had measured heart rates and blood pressure, I assure you they would have been lower than they might have been otherwise, especially if we were at home watching the news. If we could measure compassion and love for others, it would have been off the chart. If we could put in words the benefit and the beauty of long-term relationships with people of all ages, Harriet Dabrush deciding to sing her song, Mersey Doats and Dozy Doats, to Pat Greeley, her friend Pat Greeley. While in our busyness and angst we might judge these gatherings as optional, I believe we do not give them due respect simply because they are not problem-solving oriented or achievement of ends oriented, or, this is especially true of you use, at least I resonate to it, acting to change the world, that somehow always acting to change the world is what we're called to do. So my second point is that we live in an extraordinarily confusing and stressful time, and that knowing this invites us to consider our response as a covenantal community. How shall we live so that our hearts stay open and compassion freely flows? How can we move from anger and blame to understanding and action? Of late, I've found great sustenance from the work of Parker Palmer. How many of you know Parker Palmer? A lot of you, yes. A Quaker educator and retreat leader. He speaks of something he calls tragic gaps in life. Tragic gaps are those moments when we fully realize that what we know is possible from human beings is very, very far from what is actually happening. That's a tragic gap. He goes on to say that there are tragic gaps all the time in life because life isn't perfect and human beings aren't perfect. And even those we revere as changers to our cultures like King and Gandhi and Rosa Parks and Dorothy Day, even those people didn't see the fruition of their dream and their vision. They only stayed in the tragic gap and put one foot in front of the other. Parker says that there are three possible reactions to tragic gaps. One is corrosive cynicism, a reaction that believes the current tragic gap is the worst ever and that there is little to be done about it. The second is irrelevant idealism. Oh, irrelevant idealism. which is a worldview that denies the troubles and only looks at some Pollyanna view of life. Both corrosive cynicism and irrelevant idealism are lived outside of the tragic gap. Therefore, they don't affect it in positive or negative ways for the long haul. Parker says there's another choice, and that is to choose to stay in the gap, to foster a balance of activism against the tragic, and to temper that with nourishment of ideals and practice of more humane behavior. Put one foot in front of the other, trying to stay balanced. All humans will have to decide how to live within our tragic gaps. It's the nature of imperfect life. And now number three, the times we live in, as you use, I think is calling us to take a look at our covenant together. It is my belief that you all, most of you all in this beautiful congregation of lighted souls, do really well the part of our covenant that calls us to action in the world. This congregation, more than any I've known or served, does that very, very well. I was here yesterday and a group of about 10 people came and set up for Family Promise, which begins today, bringing in the mattresses and the other supplies, as we will be housing families who do not have homes here through this week. There are many other working groups here where people are living their faith in the world. But here's what I'm wondering. Do we need more in the way of soul nurture and sanctuary to balance this out? I'm asking this question. If it would be helpful to covenant together to increase this aspect of our community, what form would it take? I love this poem called Birth. I don't know its author. For this journey, bringing hope from heaven to a spoiled world, we give thanks. Grant us a traveler's hope, a place to stay furnished enough for love to be born and live. For those we know carrying a burden's weight towards an unknown conclusion, we pray. For those we do not know on journeys of despair, homeless, or losing hope, we pray and seek to act. Grant us a place to stay, furnished enough for love to be born and live. So now we're behind time, if the bells are right. So if you have to leave, you have to leave. But I'll finish anyway. So I'm asking you to think about this. Are there some ideas you have that might, in an easy way, enable us to get to know each other better, be more intimate with one another, share our stories more regularly? We are a covenantal community. One idea I have is something that Parker calls circles of trust. You get together once a month with a group of 10 or so people that is deliberately multi-generational, and there's a certain process you go through to share who you are and just receive support, not advice, support, and other things that can be done as a result of these circles. Are you someone who would take the time for that? Does that feel appealing to you as a way to obviate against all the worry and the stress that leads us to activism? It's one idea. How might we make promises to each other to pause and get to know each other better across generations? It's a huge elephant in the living room, truly, that generations we as human beings tend to gravitate toward people more like us than less. We have to be intentional about not doing that. It's easy to see why, and we have to be intentional for the great gifts we get when we are more multi-generational. So I end with just saying Lynn Unger's statement, the truth is that belonging to something is not a state, It's a process. It isn't something you have, it's something you build. It is our time here, I think, to consider creating deeper connections so as to strengthen our ability to stay in the gap with love and support and joy. Let me know your thoughts, please, in the week ahead.